Ladies and gentlemen, can I get your attention, please? All right. What I need you to do is, if you have, if you wish to stay in the room, I need you to find a seat. But before you take a seat, if you are planning to testify today, there's some sign-up sheets up on the table by the door. And rather than get all the way into your seat and then I tell you halfway through my opening comments, sign up, and then you have to walk over there, I'm telling you, this would be a good time to go to the sign-up sheet. Not everybody has to sign up. Not everybody has to testify. But if you do wish to testify, I'd ask you to sign up to the sign-up sheet. This room has a capacity, and we are not allowed to go over that capacity. It looks like we're not over capacity yet. That's good. I can see the chairs, and so I will keep track of how many empty chairs we have, but it looks like we're in good shape right now, okay? So with that, this is a pretty packed room, and as a result of that, what I'm going to tell you is that my comments are going to contain little quips that are going to sound like you're back in school. And I know most of you aren't in school now, but if you are, good for you. But if you're not, it's going to take you back to school days, because I'm going to tell you that there is no talking in class unless you're at a microphone. So no whispering, no leaning over and talking, because this is such a small room. And because there are so many of us, for whatever reason, it seems like noise amplifies. And it's disconcerting. And I'm going to tell you that I believe whoever has the microphone has everyone's 100% attention. All right? If somebody is taking the time and the effort to come and testify today, we are all going to listen, or at least we're going to look like we're listening, okay? So my opening comment is, there's nobody going to be standing here. There's going to be people in seats, and I'd ask that you take your seats. All right, so that's your first school thing. I'll talk about that later. Oh, by the way, with school, if you wish to pass notes, going back to school, and you always heard no passing notes because they always got rap knuckles on that, we can pass notes. It's okay to pass notes. It's just quiet. So if you wish to have a conversation, you take it outside. If you wish to pass a note, that is perfectly okay. All right? So let me talk about what we're going to do today. We'll try to be as efficient as we can so we get everybody to say what they're going to say. My name is Greg Frank. I don't talk about myself very much. I will be done in about 2 minutes. I am a hearings officer. I'm on contract with the City of Portland to hear land use cases. This is not the first time that I've done a land use case. I was the primary hearings officer for the City of Portland doing land use cases for about 16 and a half years. So I figure that I've done about 600 or 700 land use cases in this room alone. So that's who I am. I don't know anyone other than Mr. Fry. I do recognize him from prior hearings. I recognize a staff planner. And there is at least one other planner that I recognize from a prior case that's here. I do not have any social relationships or personal relationships with Mr. Fry, Mr. Williams, or anyone else in this room that I'm aware of. In fact, I don't think I know you, all right? That's a good thing, because it means that I don't have any bias. I don't have any, I'm favoring you, I'm not favoring you, I like you, I don't like you. I'm telling you that I do not believe that I have any personal bias. I do not believe I have any conflicts in this case, and therefore, I'm going to tell you that I'm going to continue to hear this case, all right? Let's talk about, so that's all we talk about with me. Let's talk about what you get to do. Everyone who is here today will have an opportunity to testify at least once, all right? I'm going to repeat that. If you wish to testify today, you will have an opportunity to testify at least once, all right? There are a few people that get to testify twice, and I will explain why that happens shortly, all right? So you will get to testify once. So if you have something to say, great. You have something to show me, great. If you have something to turn in, great. You will get that opportunity, because this is truly a public hearing, and anyone who wishes to testify may do so. So let's talk about who gets to go in what order, and maybe who gets to go twice, because there are some people who do that. First of all, after my opening remarks are completed, I'm going to turn to the staff planner. I didn't design this room. Despite the fact that I was here when this room opened up, I did not design this room. And for those of you who are sitting on the door side, And those of you who are standing up, which are not supposed to be standing up, you're supposed to find a seat. Those of you may wish to actually get up and move around, and I will allow you to come over in this side here so you can see better, and then you can stand. But I will allow you to do that because especially the two folks that are standing up, the screen is going to be used. And I tell you what, that is tough on the eyes. That's oblique vision at its worst, okay? And I apologize for that. So I will offset that by allowing you to get up if you so desire and come up, stand up, and see the screen. I don't know if there's anybody else going to be using the screen today, but I know that the staff planner is going to be using the screen. So I finish. The staff planner will testify. When the staff planner testifies, just like everyone else here today, he will give his first name. If you think I can misspell your name, which is not hard for me to misspell anything, if you think I can misspell it, give me your spelling of your first and last name. If you wish, I would appreciate you give us your mailing address. If you don't like to give your mailing address, because this is a recorded hearing, and I'll talk about that shortly, if you don't want to give us your mailing address, then at the end of the hearing, come up and give the clerk your mailing address. Because anyone who testifies today gets a copy of my decision in this case. All right? So we just mail out to anybody who testifies. If you don't want to testify, come up to the clerk after the hearing's over and give her your name and address, and we will be more than happy to send you a copy of the decision. So I testify, the staff planner testifies, giving first, last name, and address, and then the applicant or applicant's representative. So the applicant or applicant's representative. You'll notice it's hard for some of you in the back to see, but there are two microphones. Both work. They're both great. There's two chairs, not particularly comfortable chairs, but they're chairs. If there's an applicant and applicant's representative, both of you can come up, or two people come up at a time, and you'll notice when I get to the opposition, it'll be the same comment. All right, so applicant or applicant's representative will come up and they'll give their presentation. When the applicant and applicant's representative have completed, then I will ask, is there anybody in support of who thinks the application's a really good idea? So those people will come up and testify. So I go, staff goes, applicant and applicant's representative and supporters. At this point in time, when that testimony is completed, I will ask for anyone in opposition. We have sign-up sheets, as I indicated before. I will call your name off the sign-up sheet, all right? And you will come up, and I will probably try to keep both chairs occupied so that we don't have a lot of transition, so we can keep things moving along. But I will call up the opposition. When I'm completed with the list, if there's somebody who simply forgot to sign up or whatever, I'll make sure you get an opportunity to speak, all right? So we've gone through the applicant, we've gone through the opposition. Everybody gets to speak once so far. At the end of the opposition testimony, I'm going to turn to the staff planner and say, does the staff planner have anything that they'd like to fill in? Following that, I'm going to ask for the applicant or applicant's representative if they have anything that they wish to add. All right. After that's done, I close the hearing. All right. Most of you, I am sure, don't make it your life's desire to come to land use hearings every single week or every single day because you're absolutely fascinated with the process. And so you're probably asking yourself, well, how come the applicant gets to speak twice? Right? And that is a really fair question. And under state law, the applicant has the burden of proof to show that each and every one of the approval criteria are satisfied. In essence, what I'm telling you is the applicant has to tip. Not very much, but has to tip the scale ever so slightly in their favor that they have shown every approval criteria that's relevant is satisfied. And the state said because they have that burden, they get a second shot at the apple. All right, let's talk about what that really means practically. There's a fair number of people in here. I saw a whole bunch of people going to the sign-up sheet. That's great. We always like it when there's public participation. But I'm going to tell you that I need your testimony to relate specifically, if you possibly can, to the relevant approval criteria. And you may say, I don't go to land use. I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Speak English to me. Okay, land use people love to come up with phrases a different phrase for a common sense word. All right? I don't know why they do this. I mean, I think they think it's job security or something. But whatever, is they always come up with something new to say what we could have said easy. Let me rephrase what the applicant's burden is about and what you need to testify about. You need to testify about relevant laws and rules. Relevant, in other words, they apply to this case, laws and rules. And most of the time, what that means is that the applicant has to show that the rules that come out of the Portland City Code have been met. Okay? Does that make a little more sense? You need to show me, if you're in favor, that they've been met. If you're in opposition, you need to show me that they haven't been met. The other alternative, and staff is not perfect, they think they are, but they're not quite perfect, is that they believe that they have identified in the staff report, which there are still some in the back, staff report identifies all the relevant laws and rules. You may believe that there's another one that they forgot about. Or you may say they included one that they shouldn't have talked about. You can bring that up too. So let's talk about what your testimony should be. Is there any more staff? There are no more staff reports back there? We're going to get you some, because that is absolutely critical. Okay. So we're going to make sure that I need to make sure that your testimony relates to the laws and rules that apply in this case. It is really hard for citizens that go to real jobs, that have real lives, that don't come to these hearings all the time, to understand what those laws and rules are. I understand that. But I'm going to tell you the harsh reality is that I make my decision based on the evidence that's in the record that relates to the relevant laws and rules. People often say, well, don't you get to decide what you want? You're kind of like a mini little judge or something. Don't you get to decide what you want? No. I take the evidence that you give me in this case and I apply it to the relevant laws or rules. I can't make up new laws and rules, and I can't take away relevant laws or rules. So what are you going to testify about? The laws and the rules and the evidence that applies to that. Please do your best. I am very patient. I understand that you're coming to this hearing, most of you not understanding what these rules were before you got here, probably. Okay, I understand that. So I will listen to your testimony to a point, but I often will interrupt and say, can you tell me what law or rule this applies to? Seems unfair, but I can't make a decision unless I know what it is, all right? So that's what I hope you'll do, is talk about the relevant laws and rules. Let me tell you what you can do, because when we have large audiences like this, there's only so many important things that can be said. And so somebody before you who testifies may have said something that you really agree with or disagree with. You don't have to go through a litany. You can simply say, I agree with so-and-so's testimony about not having this or having that, and just leave it at that. You do understand that saying something twice doesn't make anything more important or more true or less true. And so from an efficiency perspective, I want you to have an opportunity to testify, but I'd really appreciate it if it wasn't repetitious testimony, because all of you have real lives and I'd like to keep this moving. I know you're listening to me and say, well, why doesn't he finish his comments so we can start? But the point is that I need you to agree or disagree with people ahead of you. Let's talk about a couple other things and I'll be done. This is a recorded hearing. You can access our recording by the staff report has a number on it. And there's some cards in the back with our website on it. Go to our website, that's the hearings office website, go to hearing recordings, and then simply put in the case number and you will be able to listen to hearing. It usually takes 2, 3, 4 days for us to get the hearing up online, but it will show up pretty quickly, and you will be able to listen to whatever I've said, you said, or anybody else said. Secondly, public record. There's going to be some people, I suspect, and we've already had some people drop off some things at the little basket in front, and if you don't want to testify, put whatever you have to testify in the little basket. If you're going to testify from notes and you want to put them in the record, put them in the basket. The basket's a good spot. Anything that goes in the basket goes into my green file. All right? This is the official file. At the conclusion of the hearing, the staff representative is going to, and he's the only person, if I close the hearing, I don't get a gavel, but if I drop my knuckles and say the hearing's over, nothing new comes in, and except for one red file, which I allow the staff to put in right at the conclusion of the hearing. All right, those two things become the official record. How do you see them? Do you get to see them? Of course you do. It's public record. You get to see them by going out the door where you came in, take a left. There's a very imposing looking window, which I know some of you saw some of you at when I walked in this morning. Go to that window, give them the case number, and that comes off the staff report. And they will allow you to go into our room. We let you look at the file. And finally, you can copy. We'll copy things for you, and we'll charge you. All right? So that's the public file. Last couple things. Number one is, and I'm not going to have any whispering, sir, in the front row. There will simply be none. And I'm always looking for my first guinea pig example. All right? And you're it. All right, so what I'm telling you is if someone does not want the record to close today, in other words, you heard some testimony and say, wow, I hadn't thought about that. I've got some way to respond to that, and I want to submit something into the record. If you don't want the record to close today, then when you testify, simply say, I don't want the record to close today. I want the hearing to stay open. Just give me some hint that you don't want it to be done today. If you do that, I'm obligated to keep the record open for not less than 7 days for new evidence from anyone, and an additional 7 days for the rebuttal on part of the applicant. Okay? It only has to be asked once, and just because two people doesn't mean 14 days and three people is 21. We don't keep adding up the days. One person asks for the record to remain open, it will remain open for 7 days. I'm not going to give you the instructions now, but if in fact somebody does ask for the record to remain open, I will give instructions about how to get information into the public record during that open record period at the end. So if you're going to leave early, remember the recording? Go on to the recording. Listen to the end of the recording. Because I will give very, very strict instructions about how to deal with it. All right. Finally, this decision that I make in this case, it may not be the final decision. And if you have a staff report, it says right on the front, says in it, towards the top, it says important to submit all evidence to the hearings officer. City Council will not accept additional evidence if there's an appeal of this proposal. What does that mean? Number one is that if you don't like my decision, it's appealable to City Council. Number two, I think is as important, is if you don't raise an issue or bring in evidence in this hearing, that includes the open record period, if you don't bring it into this hearing, it isn't going to be considered at City Council. I always like to say, don't hide the good stuff for Council. All right? Speak now and forever hold your peace, because you're going to be stuck with whatever you bring up in this hearing and whatever evidence is submitted in this hearing at City Council. All right. With that, then, I'm done. I apologize for going so long, but it's a big group, and it's really important that you understand the process. And I think it makes it go longer shorter in the long run. I'm going to turn it over to staff. As I indicated, there will be nobody standing. There will be no one standing. So if you don't have a seat, I'm going to ask you to leave, because that way I keep track of room capacity. So I need you to find a seat. And if you wish to move, the standing part, I'm sorry, standing part during his presentation, because he's going to use the screen, you can stand up. But after his presentation, I'd ask that you all take a seat. This gentleman's going to be using the screen, and it's really hard to see from where you're standing. So I'd appreciate you kind of move over there. And you can come right down front if you want and come, because I want you to be able to see. Okay? Mr. Williams, go ahead, identify yourself for the record, please.
Sean Williams, 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue, Suite 5000, Portland, Oregon, 97201.
Go ahead, sir.
All right, so before you today, we have a hearing for case file LU18-135663 LDS. Subdivision proposal at 3969 North Overlook Terrace. Just a brief summary of the proposal. The proposal is to create six lots, two tracts, an existing house that's currently being remodeled will be retained on one of the lots. All of the non-exempt trees that are located on the site are proposed to be preserved. There will be installation of a new sidewalk on North Overlook Terrace along the site's frontage. Sanitary sewer and stormwater will be discharged to a combination main in the street, and a water main will be required to serve the, all the lots as well. So this is the zoning for the property. The base zone is residential 5,000. It's R5, allows a max density of one lot per 5,000 square feet. There is an environmental conservation overlay on this site that's delineated by this kind of squiggly line that you see here throughout the site. So this portion is R5. This back portion is within the conservation overlay. The site is within also the what's called the potential landslide hazard overlay, which has implications for land division approval criteria. And then we're located within the Overlook neighborhood. Here's an aerial for some perspective. The site currently is comprised of three separate tax accounts. So the site has frontage here on North Overlook Terrace. Additionally, it has frontage on North Greeley Avenue as well. This is the existing house right here that will be retained. And then this is the heritage tree that's kind of located centrally within the site. Next, we're just going to kind of go through some photos just to give you some perspective on the site area. This is looking at on North Overlook Terrace. And then the site is to your right here. Then just kind of turning around, looking the other direction on North Overlook Terrace. This is kind of looking northwest, whereas before we're kind of looking southeast. The site is to your left on this side. This is the existing house right here that will be retained. Then just kind of closer look up of the house that will be retained. This is in the area of proposed lot 2. There was an existing attached garage that was in this location that was removed, and this is the area of proposed lot 1. And this is from North Overlook Terrace, kind of looking into the center of the site. This is the heritage tree that is proposed to be retained. And you can kind of see in the background here. So this is just kind of sitting on just kind of a bench, a bluff here. Then it goes down to Greeley down here below. Within the site, looking towards the existing house, this is the other non-exempt tree to be retained. This is an 18-inch Japanese maple. It's also looking to be retained. The house is right behind it, you can see here. This is on the other side of the heritage tree, so you have North Overlook Terrace on this side, the edge of the bluff kind of right in this area here. And just kind of getting on the other side of the heritage tree in the area of around proposed lot 5 and 6 with the house being behind there. And then this is just kind of looking off of the bluff there with the West Hills Forest Park being located across the river there. So the approval criteria we're considering today for this land use review is under 33.660.120. It's approval criteria for land divisions in open space and residential zones. And we'll kind of run through some of the relevant approval criteria now. So the first one being lots. So in terms of density for this site, because the site is located in the potential landslide hazard, there is no minimum required density. We're not going to make you build any certain amount of houses or lots when you're in those hazard areas. The maximum density for the site is 11 lots, and the applicant is proposing to create 6 lots for detached houses ranging in size from around 4,500 square feet to getting close to 7,000 square feet in area. So all the proposed lots are meeting standard requirements. Next up is tree preservation. So the applicant is proposing to retain both non-exempt trees on the site. So there's a number of other trees that are also located on the site, but they are exempt from the regulations of this chapter. A majority of those are within the environmental conservation overlay, and those trees are instead regulated by the environmental zone requirements. So the two non-exempt trees that are being retained is a 54-inch Oregon white oak. Again, that is the heritage tree that's on the site, and then an 18-inch Japanese maple. So that heritage tree is proposed to be preserved within a tract, originally identified as an open space tract. Staff required or recommended that instead be labeled as a tree preservation tract to kind of more clearly identify what the purpose of that tract is. Urban Forestry, who ultimately has authority over that heritage tree, has required a standard root protection zone of 54 feet with no allowed encroachments. There were previous iterations of the proposal that looked at some minor encroachments in the root protection zone, but Urban Forestry ultimately determined that no encroachments should be allowed in that area to adequately propose or preserve the heritage tree. And then at the time of development, Urban Forestry will require arborist reports to document the care and maintenance of the heritage tree when the houses are being built. Again, the site is in the potential landslide hazard area, so the applicant submitted geotechnical reports and a landslide hazard study to address this approval criterion, and the site development section of BDS, who's responsible for reviewing those reports, has determined that the site can be developed in a manner that reasonably limits the risk of a landslide affecting the site, adjacent sites, or sites across the street. They will also be looking at requiring further geotechnical evaluation at the time of development of new structures on individual lots. Looking at transportation impacts, nothing too impactful here. Portland Bureau of Transportation has determined that there's no impact to on-street parking supply. There's sufficient access and loading available. No intersections will necessarily be impacted negatively. They are requiring a new sidewalk to be installed on North Overlook Terrace along the frontage of the property. So the site also does, again, have the frontage on North Greeley Avenue as well. They'll be looking at having a small amount of dedication along that site's frontage and then looking at waivers of remonstrance just to allow for any future improvements should they ever happen along Greeley Avenue. But there's existing site conditions that preclude installing any kind of sidewalk or anything along that frontage as it is now. And looking at services and utilities, in terms of water service, there is portions of the site that does have access to water and portions that don't. So the Water Bureau is requiring a water main extension within North Overlook Terrace to serve all of the lots. And then for sanitary sewer and stormwater, there is a main within North Overlook Terrace. It's a combination main that they'll be able to discharge sewer to. And then for stormwater management, nothing will be discharged on site. They will look at capturing the stormwater from the roof runoff of the new homes, treating it in flow-through planners, and then discharging that to the combination main within the street. And then because the site is located within the environmental conservation overlay, there are standards that are required to be met. The environmental overlay is kind of a two-track system. You either need to meet standards for a land division or an environmental review could be triggered. The applicant has demonstrated that all standards can be met in this instance, and this is just kind of a snippet of some of the requirements that you'll see from the land division standards in environmental zones. So the reason why they're creating that large tract, Tract A, is that the resource area of the environmental zone is required to be placed entirely within that tract. A couple of the different development standards that you'll see is that there'll be maximum setbacks from North Overlook Terrace, so keeping the development closer to the street, not pushing it towards the environmental overlay zone. And then there will be a requirement to remove nuisance species within the environmental resource tract and replant with natives. So staff is recommending approval of this proposal for a six-lot subdivision that would result in six standard lots for detached houses with an environmental resource tract and a tree preservation tract, subject to conditions for tree preservation, sidewalk improvements, dedication and waivers on North Greeley, water main extension, geotech reports for future development, and compliance with environmental standards. And that's the conclusion of my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. I have no questions at this time. This will be the time and the place for the applicant or applicant's representative to come forward, take a seat, identify yourself for the record. First name, last name, spell your last name, give us a mailing address.
So it's Peter Finley Fry, that's F-I-N-L-E-Y-F-R-Y, two words, 303 Northwest Uptown Terrace, room 1, B as in boy, Portland, Oregon, 97210. So I'm a planning consultant and presenting the applicant's proposal. We need to begin by saying that we now have a new plan, which I'll hand out into the record, and I'll explain it in a second. So the new plan is almost identical to the original plan, except for two major changes. One is that we got the city's tree report a week and a half ago, and the city has decided to increase protection of the tree from its normal baseline code to not allow the 25 disturbance that's normally allowed in a heritage tree situation, and we're okay with that. We decided not to argue that point and to accept it, and as a result of that, we have moved our lot lines back to where they're generally similar. The reason they were so far apart is we thought that the portion of the tree that would be on the other two lots would not be protected because of the 25%. That's not true. So now it's all three properties, the one on each, the left and the one on the right, and the center property will become responsible for the preservation of the tree according to this mandated preservation area. The only other issue is that we are protecting trees in the environmental track, of course, but the maple tree you saw, which was given protected status unnecessarily because it doesn't require that in the code, except for findings about tree protection, we're asking that maple tree be removed from the protection status so that there would be the heritage tree and the protection status. We're not proposing removing the maple tree. And we recognize that if we were to remove the maple tree, we would have to deal with the Portland Zoning Code requires mitigation of cutting a tree down. That tree is 18 inches, which is less than the 20 inches, which is typically required. I also wanted to point out that almost 64.6% of the site is now going to be preserved forever as a result of this subdivision, and that's about a third of the whole site that will be forever preserved in this proposal. We accept the production zone, we agree with the staff report, and we have testimony from three experts. But before I go to that, I want to formally ask that the written record remain open for 2 weeks so that the city has an opportunity to respond to our change that we're requesting in the lot sizes and the removal of the maple tree. So,
excuse me, Mr. Fry. For those in the audience, I indicated that anyone had the right to ask for the record to remain open. first person testifying almost, second person, has asked for that. No one else needs to ask for that. We will be keeping the record open, and I will probably move up my instructions a little earlier in the process so that if anyone wants to leave, at least they know what their requirements are. But we'll talk about that shortly. Go ahead, Mr. Fry.
Okay, our first expert is our arborist, Todd.
You want to introduce yourself and your address?
I'm Todd Prager, last name spelled P-R-A-G-E-R. Business address is 3145 Westview Circle, Lake Oswego, 97034. I am a board certified master arborist. I'm a registered consulting arborist. I have a master of science degree from the in horticulture from the University of California, Davis. I've been an arborist for 16 years, including an urban forestry inspector for the city of San Francisco. I was the city arborist for the city of Tigard, and I've been a consulting arborist with Terrigan and Associates since 2012. I created the tree plan for the Overlook subdivision, and I worked with Portland Urban Forestry to expand the tree protection zone to the current proposal around the Oregon white oak, which is a 54-foot radius around the tree. I feel that this will provide more than adequate protection for the Oregon white oak, and it will require no pruning for construction, since the tree protection zone is well outside the drip line or canopy limits of that tree. I've worked with other projects in Portland with Heritage Trees, and the city has improved encroachments into that standard root protection zone radius of 1 foot per inch of DBH, where the city is allowed up to 25% encroachment into that area. That's the prescriptive path standard that's in Title 11 of the Portland Code. The city has allowed selective pruning for construction and excavation within that standard root protection zone for other heritage trees and other projects. However, I do agree that the 54-foot radius is appropriate for this development, that no pruning of the tree should occur at this site that will impact the tree's form, and this root protection zone will provide more than adequate protection for this heritage tree. The proposal meets the prescriptive path standards in Section 1160.030(c)(1). In Title 11 of the Portland Code, and also meets the approval criteria in 33, 630, 100, and 200 of the Portland Zoning Code. So with that, I want to keep this brief to begin with, and if there's questions, I can respond to that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, our second expert is Brad Hume. He's our geotechnical engineer expert.
My name is Brad Hupy. Our business address.
Spell your last name.
H-U-P-Y.
Okay.
Business address is 2839 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland.
Speak right into the microphone, sir.
Okay. We did the geotech.
Zip code, please.
Pardon?
Zip code.
97202.
Thank you.
We completed the geotechnical evaluation for this project site. I got to agree with most people who ever looked at the Overlook Bluff area. We thought it was an area that was had a lot of landslides and that were man-made or were natural. We did our investigation with a subsurface investigation that included two borings, and then we put down two CPTs, which are an electronic cone that push in the ground and get soil properties. We looked at the map geology of the site and the area. We discovered a lot of historical photos that we used for our reference. We looked at the DGAMI screening of the site. DGAMI is the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and they have an online tool called Slido where you can look at all the mapped landslides that they've identified through LIDAR. We did some laboratory testing, and strength testing of the soil in the upper zones of the site. The soil down the lower zone is very strong, Troutdale gravel. We didn't test that. In general, from the topo summary, the site immediately below the development area is reasonably steep. Some of that is steeper than two horizontal to one vertical, which is about 27 degrees. And some of that area right below the site is steeper than that, so it does require a slope stability analysis. The side slopes and the areas around it are less steep than that, and 2-to-1, just for reference, is the inclination of a slope you'll see along all the highways that are built everywhere. It's just considered a stable slope condition. In looking at the historical record, what we found was most of what appear to be landslides on the overlooked terrace area are in fact cuts that were made for the railroad or the highways that are alongside and down at the bottom of the bluff. So then we conducted a slope stability analysis. Our goal was to establish a safe setback from the edge of the slope. And with that, we determined, based on the analysis, that 30 feet is an appropriate safe setback from any construction of buildings close to the slope. We did a pseudo-static analysis. And in the pseudo-static analysis, we did that based on a probabilistic analysis using peak ground motions that are issued by and promulgated by the USGS. There was a little mistake in our report in that we said that we used a PGA, peak ground acceleration of 0.2. Actually, the PGA then becomes evaluated and generates a coefficient, and the coefficient is what we actually reported as a PGA, and that was incorrect. So the coefficient we use is 0.2. Based on the analysis we did, our evaluation of the site, we feel the site is stable and that the 30-foot setback is appropriate to protect the structures and people on the site and those below. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you, sir.
Ken, Peter Fry again. Our last experts, Bill Newbrook, architect.
Good morning. Bill Neburka, N-E-B-U-R-K-A. Business address is...
Could you spell your last name again?
Sure, N-E-B-U-R-K-A. Business address is 411 Southeast 58th Place, Portland, Oregon, 97215.
Go ahead, sir.
I am the architect associated with the project and also, I guess, officially the applicant. I probably have the least objective criteria to offer today. I think I'm here as much for the back of the room as the front of the room. I wanted to speak a little bit about the subdivision itself, which is...
Would you pull the microphone in front of you, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Which is, by all accounts, a pretty straightforward subdivision of a property. Each lot has frontage on Overlook Terrace. Each lot is conforming to the size constraints of R5 and really doesn't change the density of the neighborhood overall, which I think is unusual for Portland these days. I think what I wanted to speak to is obviously the neighborhood interest in the site, and I think there's going to be further testimony about the site and the tree, and speak a little bit about, at least at this stage, our interest in preserving the nature of the site and the nature of the quality and the health of the tree. We've worked very hard with the city and with urban forestry to create what we feel is an adequate protection. It's sort of an unprecedented protection for the tree itself, with no incursion into the root zone, which we're supporting as the applicants. And I think it's hard to answer a question before it's been asked, but I think there's always a lot of questions about the design of the ultimate subdivision of the site. And I think what I can speak to is the nature of the tree and where that figures into the ultimate development of the site. Obviously, it's a signature element of the site. That, along with the view, give the site a great deal of character. And I think it's obviously been a treasured portion of property in the neighborhood. I can say that sitting here that we're not the type of people that pull a plan out of a book and slap it down on a site. So I just want to kind of give that assurance that we are looking to, especially the sites directly adjacent, lots 3 and 4, directly adjacent to the tree, of how we can incorporate the nature of that tree, the nature of the natural planting that will be required in that root protection zone into the architecture of the houses. Additionally, the tree, one of the criteria that the urban forester brought up was that this tree has existed in an open field, and that has contributed to a unique canopy structure for that tree. So I think that as we have discussed, and just looking at the sites, especially lot 4, which is on the south side of the tree, the idea of how the roofs slope and how we can give solar access to the tree in a way that is not different than it exists right now will obviously be taken into consideration. Other than that, I don't think I have anything objective to offer. Just wanted to put that in the testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, it's Peter Fry again. So I want to summarize two important. We're basically saving 65% of an acre, which is approximately one third of the whole site is going to be preserved for being natural, both the environmental track and the tree track. We would like to respond to questions raised. Thank you.
You will. Don't go away. I want to, because I promised that I'd. Since we have a large group and some people may want to leave early, and I didn't want to have people having to go back and listen to the recording, maybe I misunderstood you, but I want to say what I thought I heard. You said you'd like the record to remain open for 2 weeks.
Well, we found out a week and a half ago. We did the new plans as quickly as possible. We were able to get them to the city literally last week, which is not sufficient time for city to look at the plans, and so we recognize the need for the city to look at any type of impact that's different than what was proposed. And I was informed that 2 weeks would be enough time for the city to do that.
And you're good with the 2 weeks?
I'm good. It depends on the city,
though. Is the applicant
good?
Yes. What I'm looking for, and folks, I understand that I'm trying to keep you a part of this process for the most part, but there's one part of this process that talks about timelines and when decisions have to be done, and since this has the ability to be appealed to City Council, one of the things the state law requires is that the city issue its final decision within a certain period of time, and missing that time period puts those of you, particularly in opposition, at I think a little more risk perhaps than the applicant. There may be a dispute on that particular legal position, but I'm just saying I don't want to miss our time frame. And so, Mr. Fry, if in fact you're asking for 2 weeks, then that would extend the 120-day clock for 2 weeks. Is that your understanding?
Correct. The only thing I do want to be clear on is if the testimony demands a longer written record, for example, for rebuttal, whatever, we're willing to extend the clock.
Okay. I just, at this point in time, I want to make sure that 2 weeks is an extension on the time clock.
Yeah, Peter Fry, fine.
All right. So that's good. So let's talk. Mr. Fry, you can retake your seat if you'd like,
Thank you.
We can have anyone. If somebody's going to testify in support of the application, you can come on up. I'm going to be talking for just a couple of minutes. If you've got a piece of paper, a pencil handy, this is the time that you probably want to have it out. All right, I'm going to keep the record open and I'm going to hold that time period in flux, so you may still have to listen to the end or talk to your neighbors to find out. But let me talk to you about how you get information into the record. So right now, it looks like the record's going to be open at least until the 6th of August, at least. I'm not saying that's the sure date, because if we may extend that a little longer, but that's 2 weeks, all right? So how do you get information to the hearings office if you wish to submit it? So Mr. Fry and his folks have testified, and you may have disagreed with that, or you're in support of that and want to enhance that. All right, either one, I don't care. How do you get information here? Number one is you hand deliver it. I understand that I would guess that some of you probably live relatively close to where this site is, which isn't right next door to this building, and so it's a bit of a pain to get down here. But the safest way to get information to this office, and the information submitted during the open record period, is to the hearings office. Not to the planner, not to the applicant, not to anybody else. It's to the hearings office, okay? So the safest way is to hand deliver it. You go out this door, go to that imposing looking glass window, hand it in. They stamp, the clerk will stamp with a timestamp when it comes in. When I finally set the time limits, if it isn't in by the time limit, it's late. Doesn't get read. So hand delivery is the first way. Secondly is a fax. Probably most of you don't even know what a fax is anymore. Nobody uses faxes hardly anymore. But we still have one, and we still accept information. The fax number is on the cards in the back, and you may fax it. And the third way you may get it to us is by mailing, and our mailing address is on the cards in the back. So those are your only three ways. All of you technological wizards that want things to happen instantaneously, we don't accept emails and we don't accept electronic submission of information. I'm sorry. We still haven't figured it out, at least yet. So I'm telling you three ways. So when all's said and done, you may hand deliver it, you may fax it, and you may submit it by mail. I don't know how our mail system works, and I worked here an awful long time. All I know is it becomes timely when my clerk takes it, opens it up, and stamps it, whatever time that is. It is not the time that you drop it in the mailbox. All right? Faxing it. Fax, how, I don't understand how faxes work. Engineers do, but I don't. But a fax stamps the time that it's received. Whatever time that says counts, and whatever time we stamp on it counts. All right? So right now it looks like 4 o'clock on the 6th will be the time, but I'm not sure yet because, as Mr. Fry said, we may need a longer period of time, and I haven't asked for staff's input. But I don't think anybody's going to object, especially if you're in opposition, to have another few days to submit information. So I will give you the time at the end, but that's how the information comes in. Now, since the staff is done with the presentation on the board here, I would ask that people take a seat. And I know it's uncomfortable, but I just need to know that we're within our 49-person limit. So if you could, please take a seat. Anyone here wishing to testify in support in favor of the application? Seeing, is this, yes, ma'am. Is there anyone here wishing to testify in support of the application? All right, can I get the sign-in sheet? All right, I'm going to start calling names. The first two names on the list are Dr. Phyllis Reynolds and Friends of Overlook Bluff, William F. Paulus, attorney. So those two people can come up and take a seat.
Now,
yes, sir?
I've got one thing to...
Hold up, just a sec.
Mr. Hearings Officer, William F. Paulus here for Friends of Overlook Bluff. As the list shows, I've got three witnesses for Friends of Overlook.
That's fine. I'll call them afterwards.
Okay, good.
We'll start with Ms. Reynolds.
Yeah.
Dr. Reynolds.
Phyllis Reynolds, that's R-E-Y-N-O-L-D-S, P-H-Y-L-L-I-S, 4471 Southwest Fairview Circus, Portland 97221.
Go ahead, ma'am.
I am considered a tree expert. I've written three books on trees in Portland, and I've done several inventories of Reed College, OS, HU, Catlin Gable, and several of the Portland parks. And I was on the Urban Forestry Commission when this tree was nominated to be a heritage tree. I was on the Heritage Tree Committee since its inception in 1993 to 2006, and Mrs. Pat Benson nominated the tree in the fall of 2003. My committee, the drill is that my committee go to the tree, inspect it, measure it, assess its health, etc., which we did, and we voted unanimously that this tree should be a heritage tree. Then, because it was a private tree, Mrs. Benson had to sign a form for all private owners that she would take care of the tree, and if anything had to be done to it, that she would contact Urban Forestry. She did this, and then she and I had a chat. The reason she wanted it to be be a heritage tree is because she felt she was getting on and that the tree wouldn't be saved if she died. And so she thought, and I did too, naively, that making it a heritage tree would save it. So it got saved by the city council in early 2004. And it happily lived until 2018. I have done a lot of literature research on tree roots. And I do not agree with the 54 feet that has been stated for the tree. What happens is, and I don't know if you can see this, but you've got one copy there. Anyway, there are two kind of thoughts about trees. One is that the roots go right straight down and it kind of mimics the top. And the other one is that the roots go out and the arboricultural literature, the botanic literature, all says that the roots go out at least twice the radius of the canopy. Okay, the radius of the canopy is 44 feet. And so if you take the amount that the developer wants to set aside for the tree, that's 9,160 feet, square feet. That's not going to be enough, because what happens is those roots, those little roots at the end, are the feeder roots. They're tiny. They have a symbiotic relationship with what's called mycorrhizae, fungi, and they're the ones that supply the water and the food to the tree. They are out there at least 88 feet in a circle around the tree. And if two dwellings are put on either on the north or the south of this tree, that destroys half of the tree roots. Half of them are gone, the feeding roots. And that leaves half of the roots for the tree. Now, this is a 150-year-old tree that has lived in its savanna space happily all these 150 years. And then suddenly it loses half its roots. What happens then is, and the literature supports this, it will slowly die. It cannot sustain itself. And especially if you put a sidewalk in, those roots will be cut on the east side, and it will slowly die. And when it slowly dies, the roots that go down the slope will die too. Therefore, not holding that slope. Roots hold slopes, and that tree is doing a great job of holding that slope. And when it dies, that's it. Anyway, I'm old and rickety, and I'm not going to be around when this tree dies. It'll probably take 12 years, and I suspect the developer will be mighty happy when it dies, because then another dwelling can be put in there. But as it is, those two dwellings on either side, especially if they have any foundation at all, will kill that tree. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
All right. My name's William F. Paulus, P-A-U-L-U-S. I'm an attorney at law. My address, business address, is 1207 Southwest 6th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97204. I'd like to call up Crystal Smith, who's the chair of the Friends of Overlook Bluff. That's my client. I represent the Friends of Overlook Bluff. And we will, I'm going to give some summarize our arguments here and respond to some issues in the city's staff report. And then I want to have Crystal Smith speak as the chair of the group. Also, we're going to call Kevin Hillary, consulting arborist for the Friends of Overlook Bluff. And then lastly, Dr. Scott Burns will speak for the Friends regarding the landslide risk. Okay. So,
you know, I provided some written comments and testimony on June 6th and July 6th, two different letters, which I know the hearings officer will read, and I ask you to pay special attention to that. I'll focus on a few main points there. The Friends are very concerned about the proposed development plan, obviously seen by the number of citizens in this room. The concern is that it will significantly impact the long-term health and viability of the Heritage Oak on the site, and that the landslide risk associated with the plan have not been adequately addressed by the applicant or the city. And furthermore, the conditions of approval do not protect the tree and mitigate the landslide risks associated with the plan. Now, for one, the applicant has submitted a new plan, which I haven't had a chance to see. So it's a bit at the 11th hour here. So I'm going to just rely on the previous plan, and we'll have to evaluate what the new plan says. Okay, as Dr. Reynolds said, you know, the Oregon white oak is very special in this site. It's magnificent, as you can tell from the photos. These kind of trees are becoming more rare in the urban environment due to urbanization and the lack of fire. The size, the age, and the location make this tree unique, particularly the lower hanging limbs, because it's been able to grow unobstructed for the last 150 years on this bluff. And that's a unique characteristic of this tree. Also, it's a heritage tree. Basically, it's irreplaceable, and it deserves our utmost care. And if we plan for it correctly, it will live for many, many years. If not, as Dr. Reynolds says, it will die prematurely. And, you know, the tree experts are agreeable on this point. Dr. Phyllis Reynolds, Kevin Hillary, David Heidberg provided comment. He's a tree expert, saying the plan is not protecting the tree enough. Mr. Hillary is going to individually submit an arborist petition today that has signatures of some of the leading arborists in the city, saying that this plan is not protecting the tree. FUB's not submitting this, but Ms. Smith has got a letter here from another arborist, Rick Till, who's going to provide comment to the city saying that the tree is not being adequately protected. And even apparently an urban forestry commissioner provided comment to the city, Greg Everhart, saying that the tree.
When you put information, would you put it in that little slot over there?
Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
For future
reference. That's good. Okay. And so the experts agree that the tree needs greater protection than what is proposed. The roots and limbs are an issue. And also, it needs room to grow. If not, it will die a premature death, as Dr. Reynolds said, and I'd like her prisoner analogy in her written testimony. This is equivalent to having a 40-year-old person who's healthy and well be confined to prison for the rest of their life, living on bread and water. Of course, they're going to live, but they're going to die a premature death, and it's going to be painful. Also, this tree is a community asset reflected by the people that are in this room. So, the tree preservation approval criteria pursuant to Chapter 630, Section 200, requires and allows for greater protection of the tree. And the applicant is failing to meet the burden under that code section. The critical code provision is that the tree preservation must be maximized to the extent practicable while allowing for reasonable development on the site. The special characteristics of this tree should be considered in that analysis. Up to this point, the applicant fails to do that. They haven't presented the special characteristics of this tree in their report. We must consider the health, the overall condition, and potential for long-term viability. That's what the code requires. When we're considering how to preserve this tree, and then balance that with, you know, the anticipated impact of development and tolerance typical for this species. Dr. Reynolds said this tree is intolerant to this kind of development, and FUB supports Dr. Reynolds' testimony, and we have submitted her written testimony as part of ours and relying on it. So tree preservation is not maximized to the extent practicable under 33.630.200. The roots and canopy need to be under single ownership or unified management. The roots and canopy, at least on these former plans, cross two property lines. The plan that we were relying on the south side of the tree, the canopy extended approximately 13 feet into lot 4 and about 4.5 feet into lot 3. The root protection zone extends further, that's certain. And the issues with this are multiple residential owners have, you know, ownership interests in different parts of the tree, and they're going to have different ideas about what can and cannot be done with their homestead or what they can even get away with. You know, irrigation is supposedly prohibited in Tract B, the tree preservation tract, but doesn't appear to be prohibited on lots 3 and 4. And irrigation is bad for this tree. How is urban forestry going to control that? What about landscaping on lots 3 and 4? You know, is that meaning no encroachment in the root protection zone? But landscaping has issues with bringing in vectors like, you know, plant diseases from potted plants and also firewood. There's fencing. I don't see that there's a prohibition against fencing of the property lines in here. There, as the way the plan was drawn before the applicant came in here, maybe it's the same. The lots of 3 and 4 have their property lines underneath these low-hanging branches of the trees. The fence is not practicable. Doesn't work. And because it invites pruning. And the city says they're going to impose conditions about covenants and restrictions about prohibiting pruning. But it just, the time, it in having the tree cross property lines just invites a conflict, and we should deal with it now, not later, and that's what the planning process is for. There's also issues about patios, even fire access around the tree, the way it's been crammed up against these houses. So I think we need to take a more cautious approach. And we do appreciate the city saying no encroachment in the RPZ, but the single or unified ownership of the tree is the best management practice, and the lots and tracks should be designed accordingly. Excuse me, I just repeated myself there. Look at my notes. But regarding the no encroachment in our root protection zone, it's that issue. What is an encroachment? Is it a fence? Is it a patio? Is it irrigation? Is it you know, planting trees? So those things are bad for this tree. Okay, I want to talk about the root protection zone. First of all, the applicants measured the zone wrong. The code clear, and first of all, it says a minimum, so this is section 11.60.30, says a minimum of 1 foot radius measured horizontally away from the face of the tree trunk for each inch of the tree diameter. Of a tree this size, that issue is significant, because from the face of the tree, you need to take into consideration the tree trunk. And the tree's 54 inches in diameter, the tree trunk then 27 inches in diameter, so it's 2 feet, 3 inches that you need to add to the tree's the root protection zone radius to meet the minimum standards, because it says a minimum. So the hearings officer and the city has authority to go beyond the minimum. And the applicant just keeps on going with the minimum, even though they're not looking at the special characteristics of this tree. So in that regard, I think the application fails, because their tree plan hasn't properly drawn the RPZ according to city code. Now, as Dr. Reynolds mentioned, the RPZ is just a legal term. The roots really extend beyond the RPZ. This is just a way to kind of have some development standard. But coupled with the special characteristics of the tree and the other criteria in section 33.630.200, the tree deserves a bigger RPZ zone, and we recommend 1.5 based on what Mr. Hillary's testimony. Could be more based on what Dr. Reynolds is saying, and maybe that's what it should be. But it certainly should be more, and there's strong evidence that even a reasonable amount would be 1.5. So, and also back to the measurement issue, away from the face of the trunk of the tree, the plain text allows no other reasonable interpretation of that code. And this, we provided comment to the city about this, and they didn't ask the applicant to redo their RPZ zone, RPZ. Okay, so based on all that, the tree preservation approval criteria, since the RPZ is incorrectly drawn, it makes the tree plan defective. They haven't met their approval criteria in 33.630.200. And the lot configuration should be redrawn and reevaluated based on the correct RPZ. So what's reasonable development? Because the code asks about the tree preservation should be the greatest extent practicable, but while allowing reasonable development to occur. Well, there is no minimum density here. Let's remember that. Mr. Williams mentioned that. It's because it's in a landslide area. The city council has already said it's okay to be cautious here from a landslide perspective. So that's the overriding policy. Then you have that interjected with the tree preservation code. And here we've got a heritage tree. We've got the primary example of this tree in the city. And it's going to be possibly destroyed due to this plan. And that's what we're concerned about. And I'm getting a little emotional here, so I'm sorry about that. But I think I'm channeling my group's energy here. So the tree protection in this instance has a greater balancing regarding reasonableness of the development site based on this issue of no minimum density. I mean, the hearings officer could say, you know, the landslide risk is too great and the tree, I'm just going to allow one dwelling unit here. We're not asking that. We're not trying to shut down this development. We're just trying to say the plan needs to be more reasonable based on the tree and also the landslide risk. You know, a tree doesn't follow straight lines, as I mentioned. You know, canopy goes over property lines, and we don't want that. And so what could be reasonable is the track B and the adjoining lots could be curved to accommodate the RPZ, or the RPZ could be expanded to really fully enclose the tree. I just want to point out that the average lot size here that's being proposed is 5,700 square feet approximately, but the minimum in the R5 here is 3. So there's a lot of leeway on designing different lot sizes and shapes. And ultimately, you know, lot 4 is the most egregious because it's the trees crammed up into it, and that's on the south side. Trees grow to this light. And there's some other reasons why that's egregious from a landslide perspective that I'm going to mention, but and also lot 3 with, you know, that potentially is not reasonable, but maybe it could be reconfigured with lot 2 to make it another dwelling unit there. I don't know. It's not my job to produce this, but certainly lot 4 is the most egregious lot for this tree. All right. I wanted just to get to the an interesting point is the land suitability requirement for Chapter 33.352. The city was saying there are no geological conditions that make the lots not suitable for development. Well, that's not true. We've got a landslide hazard study here, and they need to meet that, you know, it's contingent on meeting the landslide hazard issue. On that point, it's the Friends' position that the Portland Hills Fault should be considered in the slope stability analysis. We asked the city to do that. We asked the city to have the applicant do it, and they've not done that. Dr. Burns, who's professor of geology, is going to come in and testify here just in a few minutes. He's sitting here. And he's going to say that would be the cautious approach to run that. They've only run the model on the geotechnical report for the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake at a 0.2G. I didn't quite understand the coefficient issue, and maybe Dr. Burns could follow up on that. But they haven't run it for the Portland Hills fault, which is at 0.5 Gs to 0.6. And we've provided some information on that in my written materials. And caution is in order on this site due to the past landslides and steepness of the slopes. And one of the neighbors in the area, Whitney Stoffel, has provided testimony about this, and I believe he's gonna testify today, and he's gonna bring some pictures. But there is a picture right there on the second one that's part of Mr. Stoffel's exhibits that he's already submitted that shows some of the recent landslides activity and steepness of the slopes. The most recent one was in 2016. It's March, I can't remember the date, March 2016, which was not even really addressed in the applicant's report. They talk about it, but it's more significant than what they mentioned in the report. The standard that needs to be applied is under 33.632.100, and that's the landslide hazard area criteria. And when considering the development plan, the applicant must take into consideration accepted industry standards for factor of safety. That's what they're doing by this slope stability analysis, because that's their factor of safety. Currently, with the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, it's at 1.1. If it's below 1, then there's slope failure. So it's on the cusp. And if it went below 1, then you'd expect failure. But right now they're saying there's no failure, but we're saying you should run the numbers on the Portland Hills fault and that at least evaluate that and see how it affects your setbacks, because currently they're saying there's only 30 feet setback, and most of the structures are outside that. But I submitted my letter on June 6th with an email attached from Dr. Byrne saying please run the numbers on the slope stability with this new landslide fact, with the Portland Hills landslide, and the applicant hasn't done it. They didn't even address it. I imagine they might come in here and rebuttal and say, well, we don't know how active it is. It's not something we should deal with. I don't know if they're gonna say that. The city has said in its report, it's on page 6, under section D, several outstanding, it's the first paragraph, first sentence, first line, beginning. Several outstanding technical questions regarding the slope stability analyses and recommended foundation design remain unclear or unanswered. Then they give a sentence there I don't quite understand, and maybe it's kind of doublespeak. It says, However, the outstanding questions do not affect whether the lots can be developed in a manner that reasonably limits the risk of a landslide affecting the site, but how the lots can be developed in a manner that reasonably limits the risk of a landslide affecting the site. I guess they're saying that the lots as drawn, they feel like can support a development. But they're kicking the can down the road. The code requirements requires them to look at this now and then evaluate how the lot should be drawn, not later. Otherwise, interesting, if you look over here,
I'm gonna just get up here. I don't know if the microphone can hear me over here.
Not very okay. Well.
I'm just gonna, lot 4, I'm gonna point that out, maybe.
I have it right in front of me.
Okay, good. If you look at the lot plan that was before us, before the applicant submitted something today, you look at lot 4, and the development has now been pushed kind of in, we call it the dog run property, and a lot of the structure's been pushed towards the bluff. And that just, if giving the maximum building space, you know, that just, that's going the wrong direction, which we should be moving away from the bluff. And actually, if you get, when I measured that, that is when within 20 feet of the top of the slope, not 30. So they're broaching on that design. They're even violating what their geotech engineer is recommending. Once again, that lot four is just, it's, they're just cramming the tree in between that lot and the building. Another thing is the foundations, if they build something there, the foundations would have to go deeper potentially because to stabilize. And the tree, that's going to be really bad for that tree and the roots. And the tree, as Dr. Reynolds was saying, is helping stabilize that slope. And so if the tree dies here, then the whole thing could go. And that's bad for everybody. So I'm going to just finish my comments here, and I'm going to have Ms. Smith speak on as chair of Friends of Overlook Bluff. And I'm probably done with my comments, but I'll call up the witnesses, and if you have any questions for me, you can ask for them. Thank you.
Thank you. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Crystal Smith, that's C-H-R-Y-S-T-A-L, Smith, regular spelling. My address is 3967 North Overlook Terrace, Portland, Oregon, 97227. Good morning, Mr. Frank, and glad to be here, and I appreciate your work on this. I want to talk a little. I'm not going to go to the legal issues and the criteria that you were referring to. I just want to give you and the rest of the people in the audience some background on Friends of Overlook Bluff, or FOOB as we call it, and why we are concerned about the future of this tree and how we've gotten to where we are. As we've said, and all indications are, this tree is sat on that. Piece of property. It wasn't a piece of property. It was just a field out there on the bluff for over 150 years. Now, I went to look and see something about what was happening in Portland 150 years ago. Portland had just become organized city, only on the west side, of course. There were about 7,000 people, and that tree was out there growing in a field, undisturbed. And it wasn't until just after the turn of the century that even that area was developed. But from that time, when that area was developed, nobody has disturbed it. Nobody has put, so far as we know, there's never been anything built on that property. It's been there undisturbed, and which makes it special. It also means that it has grown to adapt to that environment. So neighbors have been concerned about that as development has happened. As we heard from Dr. Reynolds, Mrs. Benson, the previous owner, came to the city and asked to have it protected, and that was great. That was 2004, not too long after that. I'm not sure when she died. Her son inherited the property, and with understanding that he knew it was a heritage tree, but he also, we in the neighborhood knew that it was a heritage tree, and we wanted to be sure to protect it. So in 2000, and some people have been working on this for a lot longer before Friends of Overlook Bluff was actually formed, but in 2012, a group of people got together and said, there's development going on all around us. They're starting to tear down houses. They're starting to put up apartments. We need to protect this land and this tree. So we formed an organization called Friends of Overlook Bluff. And the original mission of Overlook Bluff was, of Friends of Overlook Bluff, of FOOB, was not only to preserve that tree, but to conserve the entire lot. Well, it would be the lots that are basically 3 through 6 on the new setup, because the other two tax lots were not included at that time. There was a house there, and we wanted to just say that the organization had convinced the city, Parks and Rec, to take ownership of the property if we could get money enough to buy it. We had, and it would be, our concept was to turn it into a publicly accessible natural area. We would have replanted with native plants. We had some plans. We had work parties. We had Solve support. We had East Multnomah Soil and Water support. We had a lot of people coming to work on our work parties where we were trying to get rid of native species, both on the bluff. Neighbors allowed us to go farther north along there, so down on the slope, and then we planted things. We also were working with Bureau of Environmental Services specialist in revegetation of the whole east escarpment. So we were going along. We were doing our thing. We wanted to have that. We wanted to clear up the bluff so that we could get rid of the invasives. And then eventually there was a concept that we would be putting we hope we could get a trail through to some of the other bluff properties, because it's not just Overlook Bluff. As you know, it goes along clear up to the university and past. And there are other efforts along various places along there to save the natural materials and natural resources there. So that was the, you know, it was a big mission statement when we first started. We learned a lot about the ecology. We learned a lot about oak trees, because none of us were experts in it. And the various agencies that I've discussed, including Metro, with a lot of help, were teaching us. The organization's board put together a grant application, put together several grant applications, but put together a successful grant application to Metro. We got a Nature and Neighborhoods matching grant, and then we proceeded to try to match it. I wasn't on the board at that time, but as I understand it, we had an agreement with the owner that he would sell it to us at the price that it had been appraised at. We got the grant to cover that price. We started raising the rest of the money. We had a grant from East Multnomah Soil and Water. We had a grant from Port of Portland. We had a grant promised from Overlook Neighborhood Association. And about a year plus into that process of raising the money, the owner basically pulled the plug on us and said he was going to put it up for development. He was going to sell it for development. He was going to sell it for two and a half times what he had agreed to sell it to us for. So about 2 years went by, and we were in limbo. We didn't know. We knew we wanted to be sure it was saved. A lot of developers and builders came and went on the lot and looking at it, and we just kind of went, well, sometime something will happen. Well, in July of 2017, as you know, the new owners bought it, and we then figured what we better be ready to deal with this. So we kind of restructured ourselves, and we got ourselves to the point where we are today, where we are trying to protect the tree for the long term. As we've discussed, it's a middle-aged tree. It's going to last, if treated appropriately, it will last a whole lot longer than any of the houses built on that property, and a whole lot longer than any of the rest of us. If not treated appropriately, it will die, as Dr. Reynolds said. So we are asking that we have reasonable development. We are not, as Mr. Paulus said, we're not opposed to development on the land at this point. We know development's going to happen, but we want reasonable development, and I think that and responsible. We expect both the city and the developer to be responsible and reasonable in terms of what's going on. So that's basically the study, the story of FOOB. We've worked really hard. We were very lucky to get a donation from a generous tree lover that allowed us to put together this legal team, and we hope that you're listening to them.
Thank you. I hope I'm listening too. That's it. Ms. Smith, I very much appreciate your testimony. But I'm also looking at the clock on the wall.
Right. Yeah.
And I want to make sure everyone else gets to testify.
Sure,
so I'm going to refresh my earlier comments, at least briefly. Number one is, if you agree with something that's been said, you're more than happy to come up and say, I agree. If you disagree, you can say that. But to say it all over again, I think it's going to put us in kind of a time crunch getting to around the lunch hour. And I would hope that we could all move along on that. Secondly, and I was patient with Ms. Smith, because I think it's a really interesting story, and from that perspective. But everyone else who's testified up until now has been pushing pretty hard the approval criteria and how to interpret the approval criteria and how it applies to this particular case. And I'd hope that the rest of the testimony goes there, because as much as I'm sympathetic to Ms. Smith's testimony, the history of FOOB, that's cool, the history of that is not going to make the decision go one way or the other. And so I'm more talking to anyone who hasn't yet testified. I'm not knocking or criticizing, because I very much appreciate it. And I know you all took time to come down here. But I also want everyone to be able to speak. So, Mr. Paulus?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Frank. Okay, FOOB would like to call Kevin Hillary as to provide testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Hillary, H-I-L-L-E-R-Y, address 5225 Southeast Madison, Portland, Oregon, 97215. I was asked by Friends of Overlook Bluff to be their consultant on this topic, and today I'd like to talk about three things: the current condition of T1, the Heritage Oregon White Oak, its tolerance to impacts, and the city's minimum root protection guidelines adopted by the developer's arborist on this project. So this is a remnant tree in its natural setting. It's an oak savanna. Oak savannas are grassy, spread out forests. One of the biggest threats to oak savannas in the Willamette Valley is the natural succession of other tree species like Doug fir. When Doug fir moves in, it competes for root space and shades out these oaks. Oaks are very sensitive to root loss and crowding and shade, and they start to decline rapidly. And I do look at this comparison similar to the development that is being proposed. You would think oak's a tough tree, but mostly that's its lumber. It does not tolerate impacts or changes, and it is notoriously hard to transplant, so Portland does not have very many Oregon white oaks. Not all trees are sensitive. Trees like a sycamore, willow ash, cottonwood are very tolerant to changes in their environment. They thrive on the impacts of the city. But trees like Oregon white oak, walnut, dogwood, or even vine maples can't tolerate even small changes such as summer watering. And then young trees are different than old trees. They have way more vigor, and they spend their life spreading their roots out. Old trees do not have the vigor of young trees and cannot as easily replace roots furthest from the trunk. And the roots are the most vulnerable part of a tree. Now, the city has a heritage tree program and a root protection zone, and I'm very encouraged by this, by what the progress the city has made and by the progress modern arboriculture has made. The heritage tree program started a long time ago, 93. I joined the Heritage Tree Committee shortly thereafter and was a member till 2004. I was a member when this tree was nominated in 2004. This Heritage Tree Program is a promise by the city officials that these trees will be around for future generations. Before 2004, this tree could have been taken down. In 2015, the city came up with another encouragement. The city came up with Title 11. And in Title 11 are those guidelines that we're going to be talking about. That's the guidelines are the minimum 1 foot root protection for 1 inch trunk space at breast height is equal to 1 foot of root space. So that would mean a 20 inch tree would have 20 feet of space. This is a minimum guideline that just focuses on the size of the trunk. It's blind to the tree species tolerance to impacts and age. This is fantastic for the younger trees, but it doesn't acknowledge that an old tree and those with low vigor are less tolerant of construction impacts and therefore need a larger root protection zone. So basically a 20-inch tree on the city code would have the same minimum guidelines as this remnant Oregon white oak. So what does the research say? I agree with Dr. Reynolds on the spread of roots, but I want to know specifically, what does a remnant old Oregon white oak need? So I got on the phone and started calling and emailing experts in Oregon, Washington, researchers, scientists, and professors, and there is no research that I can find on these trees. One professor at Oregon State Forest Health, Dave Shaw, who is an expert on oak diseases, wrote to me and said, oh God, I gotta say it. He actually said, cheese and crackers, Kevin. I don't know about old oak research at all. I've been amazed by the lack of work on Oregon oaks. I think the California arborist might be the best contact for work on this subject. And I got the same response down there. No one knows about any research. And finally called upon Dr. James Clark, who wrote this book, Trees in Development, A Technical Guide to Preservation of Trees During Development. And he said he was afraid he didn't have any information for me, that my best choices would be to reach out to my colleagues in the region. And if I think the root protection zone should be 1.5 instead of 1 foot, you can make that argument based on your experience. And the response of the tree to transplanting. So I did that. I polled and surveyed my colleagues in the region, some of the best. And Portland's got some high quality arborists. And it was, I've got a petition to submit. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't like going to a grocery store and trying to get petitions. Arborists are very opinionated, hard to get on the phone. And I'd like to just bring up five people I contacted. One was Brian French, who's on the Urban Forestry Commission currently member of the Heritage Tree Committee. It took me 2 days and over 3 hours showing him documents and photos before he finally agreed and said that it's 1.5 feet for remnant Oregon oaks. Stephen Peacock, arborist, been arborist longer than I have. He's been on the Heritage Tree Committee from its inception. And that was a 2 hour meeting with all the documents and photos and lots of opinions. And he also agrees 1.5 feet. Then I reached out to Fred Nielsen, curator of Hoyt Arboretum from 1986 to 2001, another long meeting, 1.5 feet. And then the current curator of Hoyt Arboretum, Martin Nicholson, from 2008 till today, also concurs, 1.5 feet. And one of the arborists who was involved in writing Title 11, Jim Plato, you know, phone conversation, he was out of town and said he agreed to 1.5 feet. So there's every arborist I talk to, there's a consensus in the arborist community that this tree needs more than the minimum that the city is providing. And then I thought, is it too hard of an ask for 1.5 feet for the city? So then I did a quick Google search, just that, 1.5 feet for 1 inch DBH, and it was a long night. There's many towns and cities and counties that prove it. I'll submit these. City of Eugene, 1.5 feet. City of Medford, tree protection root zone, 1.5 feet of critical root radius. This is the minimum you need to protect. Larger the area, the better. Minnesota, which has oak savannas, which I didn't know about before. For each inch tree diameter, 1.5 feet root zone radius must be protected. Even Alabama. The most prominent one I found was the county of Santa Barbara. I like this one specifically because it talked about oak trees. And they have Oregon white oak. And that, in the county of Santa Barbara, they require the preservation of trees and oak woodlands to the maximum extent feasible. It's a phrase they use multiple times in this report, maximum extent feasible. Countywide policy requires native trees to be preserved to the maximum extent feasible. Oaks are specifically called out for protection. For larger old growth characteristic trees with a DBH of greater than 24 inches, the distance should be increased by 1.5 feet from the trunk for every inch DBH. So I've been encouraged by this and wanted to end my testimony there. But I got a call last week from a homeowners association in Southeast Portland who has a heritage tree number 323, and the tree is in decline. Here's a picture I'd like to submit of the tree. It's a paradox walnut, gigantic, the only paradox walnut in the city of Portland. This housing development was put in 2014. It's a heritage tree. I've been talking with the Heritage Tree Committee. They will probably delist this tree this summer. This tree is in a rapid state of decline, and the Homeowners Association will have to be dealing with this tree within the year or next year. And the development's called Paradox 50. So I would just like to say to the hearings officer in the city of Portland, you have the support of the arborist community to not use the minimum requirement, and to specifically on this tree, try to do the maximum extent possible.
And Kevin, Mr. Hillary, do you have that a petition you wanted to submit?
Yes, submit the counties, the emails, the photograph, and the petition.
And there is I mentioned it in my written testimony, but Mr. Hillary's got a written petition of a number of arborists that are signed off on the 1.5 root protection zone, 1.5 feet per inch of root protection zone, and other issues regarding the tree, regarding its protection. So you got, okay.
One more point, though, if I can say. Mr. Williams took some pictures of the tree, and they look pretty recent. And I wonder for the record if they could be said when it was taken. Do you know if I can ask that question?
Go ahead.
About a week ago.
In Title 11, it does say that a protection fencing consisting of a minimum 6-foot high metal chain link fence be installed prior to any ground disturbance activities, including clearing and grading. And from those pictures, it really looks like the project has started on the existing house. And I've heard from the community that actually construction workers have parked right at the base of the tree in the trunk to get in the shade. So I wonder if...
I'm not going to have him answer that question.
Okay.
Oh, no, I'm not. I just want to know
his
the
testimony.
Time.
Okay.
Just right. The time that, in my opinion, the construction... tree protection fence should be up before those photos.
All right.
Were taken.
Thank you, Mr. Hillary, and submit those documents to the hearings clerk. Thank you. Next and last witness here is Dr. Scott Burns. Thank you, Dr. Burns. Could you just kind of state why we called you here and state your qualifications? State your name and your address, and then your qualifications, and why did we FOOB call you here?
Scott Burns, business address, Portland State University, Department of Geology, P.O. Box 751, Portland, Oregon, 97207. And I am here to address one thing, and that's primarily landslides. So my credentials, I'm a registered geologist, certified engineering geologist in the state of Oregon. I actually am on the board of state geology here. Past president of the American Group, the Association of Engineering Geology, and present president of the International Association of Engineering Geologists. So we do a lot of work with landslides. I've been teaching for 48 years. I've been working with landslides since 1976. I've been back in Oregon where I grew up the last 28 years working on landslides during that whole time. 1996, we studied all of the landslides that occurred in Portland with my grad students. We mapped 710 landslides in the Portland area and really got an idea of all the characteristics of landslides in Portland. And Mr. Hupe just mentioned Slido, all of the landslides in the Portland area that are in the Dogami website for this are primarily out of our studies from that before. And so I have a big background in that particular area. I offer free advice to all of the cities, City of Portland and the surrounding areas on landslides because landslides are a great concern to me. And I'm not against development, I'm just for proper development that we have got. Also, just an evaluation of the people working in this, I've worked with the staff here, the City of Portland, quality people, doing the work. And then I've also worked with Mr. Hupe and then also Dave Rankin, who did the development, and again, quality people that are there. Why am I interested in landslides? And I'm just going to do three things. Number one, why am I interested? A little bit about the evaluation, and then three recommendations, and I'm done. Number one, in all these work that I've done with landslides, landslides are not insured by homeowners insurance, and so if your house is hit by a landslide or slides down the hill with a landslide, you lose everything. And it just breaks my heart when that happens, so I try and get people not to develop in areas where there may be a landslide and a landslide may occur in the future. I don't like building in landslide prone areas. You can see here, 2 years ago, we had a landslide here. 1996, we had that whole area around Swan Island, many, many landslides out there. The one characteristic, which is good for the homeowners, is they tend to be shallow. And they are not big, deep ones, so you don't have to worry about a large landslide occurring a block and a half away. Landslides are caused by two things. Either rainfall, heavy rainfall, or earthquakes. And so the analysis that was done by Mr. Hupe and also Mr. Rankin, slope W is standard of practice. That's what I teach in my class. They did the right thing in this. And this is a slope stability analysis and say, if we're going to build a house here, what are the potential for the landslides? And it has two different things. The static one, that is for rainfall. And rainfall, what happens is you put all the characteristics of the slope, the geology in, it cranks out a number, factor of safety. If the factor of safety is above one, then it is going to be stable. If it is less than one, it is problematic. And so they did it for the rainfall one, and it everything turned out okay. We also recommend earthquakes, and we have two sources of earthquakes here in Oregon. Number one is the big one, the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, where it breaks from Northern California to British Columbia, creating a 9.0 earthquake that we had. The last one was 318 years ago, in the year 1700. And that will cause huge amount of destruction all up and down the coastline. They did the proper thing. They used 0.2G. That is G acceleration due to gravity, and that is what we recommend. And the factor of safety came out 1.1, so that's good. The other thing, here in Portland, we have this large fault that is right in back of us called the Portland Hills Fault. Very, very distinctive. The West Hills have been uplifted from that. Earthquake on that is not going to be a 9.0, it's going to be a 6.5 to 6.7. Less magnitude, but it's going to be shallower, and the acceleration of the earthquake waves going through is going to be greater. And so the standard practice is we use 0.6G in the analysis that is there. And that's what Mr. Hupe mentioned as pseudostatic. So he did everything properly. And then you come up with the setbacks. And they just did with the 0.2G for the pseudostatic and for the rainfall and got the 30-foot setbacks. So my basic requests are three. Number one is to go in and also do the slope W using 0.6G for the Portland Hills fault. It was mentioned earlier that is that fault active? Geologists have not. Active means it's gone off in the last 10,000 years. We had, because of the urbanization, we have not seen the offset. We do not know if it's active or not. But all geologists will agree, based on the steepness of it, that it is active. You also have other faults in the area, East Bank Fault, the Oldfield Fault. They also could go off. They could also, they're not quite as long, but they could also cause big quakes. So number one, do additionally 0.6G in slope W. Also, I have concern about site number four over here, and the setback there is not 30 feet anymore, and they've encroached out towards the edge of the slope, so I have concerns about that, and I don't know what the new design is, too. And then site six, which is down to the right there, if you look at the slope there, it is very steep right off of the end of it, and I think after the analyses, then reevaluate all of the sites. So that's my testimony. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Burns. I just have two other comments, then I'll be done. Mr. Frank,
Regarding, I forgot to mention in the regarding the landslide, just for context, there is a current, it's in the record, it was submitted by Mr. Stoffel, there's a current enforcement action against the downslope property owner to this site, which is Union Pacific Railroad. They own the property in between the site and Greeley Road, and due to this landslide that occurred in 2016, somebody filed a zoning complaint with BDS, and so that's an active file. It's just, I think it's important to know that there's other landslide issues going on with this site. And lastly, I'd like to conclude about the tree, is if the tree will die prematurely due to the plan design, how can we say that it's being preserved? With that, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yep.
It's time and place for John ULSH. Is that person here? All right. Christian Tresbel.
Good morning. My name is Christian Trable, chair of the Overlook Neighborhood Association. My last name is spelled T as in Tom, R E J, B as in boy, A L. Address is 2436 North Wygant Street, 97217. I will try to be brief. The Neighborhood Association unanimously voted at our July board meeting to seek out maximum protection for this tree consistent with the Urban Forestry Department's recommendations. Given that Urban Forestry has recommended the 54-inch root protection zone, I guess we are satisfied with that, with the exception that we agree with FOOB's attorney that the zone should be measured from the face of the tree as stated in code. It's tough for us because we have dueling arborists on both sides and we represent both members of Friends of Overlook Bluff and the developer. Our goal is to have the code enforced. This is, just to be clear, an iconic tree. You've heard this multiple times. I just want to add that it is so iconic that it is on our logo, and we recently held a logo design contest to update from our 20-year-old logo, and the majority of the submissions featured this tree. So it is iconic. We also agree with the FOOB attorney that in an ideal world, the property lines would be drawn to protect the root protection zone. I think we have concerns that if the property lines extend over the zone, future property owners would be tempted to do things detrimental to the tree, not least putting up a fence. We like in the staff report and recommendations that provisions C10 and 11 and D1 and 2 do create specific protection zones and require a plan in advance. We would request that under section D2, the exception that unless specifically approved by Urban Forestry be removed from the protection, from the provisions. That is not required by code, to my knowledge. And if we are going to protect this root protection zone, which the developer seems to agree is worth protecting, let's just protect it in perpetuity. I was a little disturbed to have new plans dropped on us here this morning. We have not had an opportunity to review those. We have some questions about whether it is appropriate to remove the second tree from protection as proposed by the developer this morning. I await an opportunity to review their analysis of that as well as Urban Forestry's. And with that in mind, I would request that the period for comment be extended not just 2 weeks for city staff, but for at least a week beyond city staff submission of their analysis so that we have an opportunity to review that. So if city needs 2 weeks, we'd like a 3-week extension of the comment period. And that is all my comments. If you have any questions from the neighborhood, I would be happy to answer them.
No, sir. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Edward.
It's man, I decline. My points have been made.
Okay. Thank you very much. Robert V, is it V-N-O-W-L-E-Y?
Yeah, it's Knowles.
Okay. Oh, there's the K. I was having a hard time with the first letter. It looked like a V.
Robert Knowles, last name spelled K-N-O-W-L-E-S. I live at 1930 North Skidmore Street, 97217. And I think because there's been so many points made, I don't really need to go over very many of them that I agree with. But I would like to just make a couple points. This tree is as old as our city. And to lose things like that only exacerbates the development problem we seem to be inheriting as sort of a reputation of knocking down old neighborhoods and not really nurturing what we have as a resource. And that brings me to this, I'd like to say. This is our country. Cherish these natural wonders, cherish the natural resources, cherish the history and the romance as a sacred heritage for your children and for your children's children. Don't let selfish men or greedy interests skin your country of its beauty and of its riches or romance. And that's by a guy who governed himself by the law, by policy and government, and that was Teddy Roosevelt, who's far smarter than me by a long shot, who cared about our environment. I think a lot of the things I'm hearing so far is about minimums, and I think when it comes to things of this nature, nurture doesn't really have minimums in its sort of definition. It's about giving latitude to things that are living and that need to be loved and preserved. And when you push minimums in a nurturing kind of environment, it doesn't work. Things don't get nurtured, hard edges, and things don't grow as they should. And I have a letter here from my wife, who was so upset, compelled me to come here, so I'm here. But I'm just going to submit this. Can I submit this letter into the record versus read it?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Knowles, I appreciate your testimony. And one of the things, I made a promise, and I will tell you the upside and the downside of that promise, and I didn't mention it earlier, is that anything that's submitted is read by me. So 100% of things that are submitted by me. I'm not sure if Mr. Finley Fry was part of it. Were you part of the Port of Portland Master Plan? I don't think so. I made that comment to the port. We were doing a master plan for the airport. And I said, I promise you that I will read everything. And if you think today is technical with earthquakes and point Gs and sixes and whatever and twos and all kinds of good engineering stuff, I will tell you that noise is equally complex with the airport. And so I said, I will read anything you say. And one guy gets up and he says, well, I've got 2 500-page books. They're yours. Read them. And he put them in the record. I am not a noise engineer, but I promised him that I would go through with him. I went through every page. I didn't say I understood it, but I read it. And things that are submitted, quite honestly, have a, I call it a shelf life, have a better shelf life, because if I'm going through something and I go, oh, there it is, and I'll highlight it, and I'll come back and look at it. I take really good notes. I'm now on page 7 of my notes, single-spaced. And I'll read my notes, but I didn't take 100% of everything that everybody wrote down. And I have to read everything that you do. So I'm just telling you, your comment, Mr. Knowles, about submitting something, I will read it, and I will read everyone's submission. It doesn't mean I understand it, but I will do my best to understand it. All right. Whitney Stoffel.
Submit this for the written record.
Sure.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Whitney Stoffel, last name S-T-O-F-F-E-L. I live at 3978 North Overlook Terrace, Portland, Oregon, 97227. This is directly across the street from the proposed development site. And I'm a legally covered landholder under Portland City Code 33.632.100. And as a legally covered landholder directly across the street from the site, I believe the proposed land division and development at 3969 North Overlook Terrace does not meet the landslide hazard area approval criterion outlined in that Portland City Code 33.632.100. This proposed development site sits directly on an historic and active landslide zone, and I do not feel like the risk of landslide has been reasonably assessed, or that this plan takes mitigation concerns into their plan. It says right here that geotech reports are required for future development. It seems like was previously discussed, we should not kick the can down the road, and this needs to be addressed now, whether these sites are safe to develop. I don't think that the lots should be divided until the proper geotechnical reports are done, which the city has said further analysis is required here. We shouldn't be dividing the lots until that's done. This is a long history of landslides. In the aerial photographs that the geotech report, it shows landslides in 1936. There's a slide in 96, which Dr. Burns talked about. And then in 2016, on March 9th, 2016, there was a very large landslide that has not been properly assessed by the city. The city of Portland sent out a BDS engineer. They don't even have the correct date of the landslide in their report. They call it the 2015 slide. But if you look at portlandmaps.com, in my written testimony, I've submitted exhibits that show a very large landslide that occurred in early March of 2016. After that slide occurred, the city of Portland came out in August 2016. BDS required that Union Pacific, the current property holders just to the west of the proposed development site, have to mitigate slope failure because it is an active and dangerous landslide zone. And in their report, which I have submitted as one of my exhibits, they actually state that Union Pacific needs to obtain a geotechnical expert and submit a plan within 1 month to the city. It's been almost 2 years now. They're accruing fines of $1,000 a day. I talked to the BDS geotechnical engineer, Erica, last week. Union Pacific still has not submitted a plan to stabilize this slope. The current houses are at risk of failure. The proposed development does not even address this. In the letter from City of Portland to Union Pacific, they state right here, the Director of Bureau of Development Service has determined the conditions of the above referenced property, which is the property in between the proposed site and Greeley Street, to be hazardous to the occupants of that property and or adjacent property and of public and private in accordance with Chapter 24.7, Building Regulations of the City of Portland, and Chapter 29.20, Property Maintenance Regulations of the City of Portland. The hazardous conditions on this property must be remedied to address the safety of the property and the public. And this hasn't been done. It's been 2 years. And now we have a development plan that comes in, and their own expert said that they should have a 30-foot setback. Lot 4 doesn't have a 30-foot setback. That's an active landslide zone that has not been properly mitigated. And then Lot 6, they said themselves they need at least a 30-foot setback from the top of the slope. You can see the house on Lot 6 is built right over the top of the slope. I think that more study needs to be done by the city. They need to address the dangers of an active landslide zone, and they need to come up with a plan on how they're going to mitigate it, whether Union Pacific is going to be responsible, the City of Portland is going to be responsible, the current landowner is going to be responsible, or the future landholders. Another concerning part of their plan is their environmental resource tract that they're building in the back. That's going to be a shared ownership in an HOA, which means lots 1 through 6 are going to have shared ownership of a dangerous landslide active zone in the back of the property. So what happens if lot 6 goes and there's no insurance, as Mr. Burns had talked about previously? And so who's going to be liable? Is Union Pacific going to be liable because they did not mitigate the slope when ordered by the city and properly fix it? Is the city of Portland going to be liable because you have not forced Union Pacific to fix this slope and then have allowed development on it, knowing that this is dangerous property and it should not be developed upon? Or is the homeowners association going to be liable because house number six goes down the hill and they don't have insurance? Since they have joint ownership in the back of that environmental resource tract, does it then become house number one's financial responsibility? I don't think it's been thought out who's going to take responsibility for if something bad were to occur, which we know is going to happen here. I mean, it's an active landslide zone. There are landslides happening to this day that have not been fixed, and we should not develop this property until it's more closely evaluated by the BDS geotechnical engineer on whether this is even a suitable site to be developed, and if so, how are you going to mitigate the risk? Are you going to put a retaining wall in, as in my report I've shown was required on 2402 North Blandina, which is a similar site on the east side of the bluff? They required a retaining wall. I see no plans here. It says further, you know, geotech reports are required. Well, we need them now. We need to address this plan now. And in closing, I would just like to say that I'm a medical professional, and everything decision that we make is risk versus benefit analysis. Every treatment that we do, has the benefits have to outweigh the risk. And when I look at this plan, I see a lot of risk. I see Union Pacific taking risks for allowing development above them when they haven't fixed the landslide. I see the city of Portland taking the risk for allowing this development to happen without having properly fixed an active landslide zone. I see the current neighbors with a lot of risk. We have houses that could go at any time if this isn't fixed, and if the land's disturbed, and if the tree dies, and if that causes slope failure. That's our houses, that's our property, that's our livelihood. And the future homeowners, their safety of the future homeowners is the biggest risk of all. I personally would never live in one of these houses across the street because I've been there for 10 years and I know I don't trust that slope and it could go at any time. And unless it's fixed, there's no way I would live in one of those houses across the street. And you weigh that against the benefit. And the benefit is that Brandon Brown, the developer, makes a couple million bucks and then walks away and leaves everybody else holding the bag of liability. And that is not an appropriate decision for the city of Portland to make. I thank you for our time, and please read my written comments. I appreciate it. Have a nice day.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Stoffel. No, no, there's no clapping, please. All right, Alexander Jones and Kim Breas would be next.
Hello, my name is Alexander Jones, and I live at 4515 Northeast 19th Avenue.
Spell your first name, please.
Alexander, A-L-E-X, A-N-D-E-R, Jones, J-O-N-E-S.
Okay.
I mean, the zip
probably
code
shouldn't
on
have
that,
to ask.
The zip code on that address? Is 97211.
Okay, go ahead, sir. Speak right in the microphone.
Thanks. Thank you for being here, Mr. Frank, and also the city staff, and also everyone here. My traditional elders are Lakota, Cherokee, Chumash, and Quechua. They are Welsh, they are Irish, they are Scottish, they are German. They call me the name Seed, and they do that because it's my job, my first job here in this place, to listen. By trade, I am a skilled earthen masonry builder. I build load-bearing houses, major scale projects. I've worked on things like the Rebuilding Center. I've worked on several ADUs around town. And I work for a nonprofit called City Repair in the education and production of these buildings and community settings. Growing up, I learned it's always important to listen. Listen to the elders, listen to the land, listen to the ancestors. It's a different kind of testimony I might give today, but I appreciate you listening to it here because it's important to me. And it's important to many cultures who have lived here for many, many years, much longer than the city has been around. I wrote some things down and I'll just be reading off of them. I learned as a young kid that we are all related. All the one-leggeds, all the two-leggeds, all the four-leggeds, all the winged ones, all the finned ones, all the creepy crawlers, and all the decomposers. I learned that also part of those relations are the ancestors and the unborn children. When communities can again come together and remember these relations as they have before, as the Chinook, the Kalapuya, and the Malala peoples have since time immemorial on this land, there will again be a time where we can drink out of the Willamette and the Columbia rivers. What a beautiful, beautiful memory that has once happened on this land. I hope deeply in my heart that we acknowledge this sacred tree, as a baby step, a first beautiful reconnection in remembering what it means to walk on the sacred bones of the ancestors who fertilized the soil and give this tree life. It's ecologically proven that trees bring communities together, not just human communities, although I would say it's bringing all of us together in this room right now. It's kind of exciting. But we're all very smart people in this room, every single person. We know the birds and the mushrooms and the plants of all kinds come together and they gather around the trees. We know that trees influence the weather and that they certainly influence landslide risk and mitigation. We also walk on this land every day, the same land that's been fertilized by the bones of those ancestors. Each one of us has a choice to do that in a respectful way or a disrespectful way. I think that while working in construction, I find that often accidentally, heavy machinery, material storage, accidental trucks parked in the shade, whatever it may be, I'm not interested in the specifics of everything right now. Root systems accidentally get trampled often. And those root systems exist in a very fragile and gentle balance with the land. They don't have the same political struggles we do. They're in a much more delicate space where things come and go in the flow of time that we see over the generations. I think that assuming a 54-foot radius is enough for this sacred old tree is a bit irresponsible and very disrespectful. I think that to disturb this balance that not only the tree exists within, but the ancestors who are still here, both living and dead, and our children's children's children who will be here in the future, I think it adds a bit of insult and injury to this already violent and disrespectful era in time. We all have choices to make in life. I respect that. We also have power to influence the way that our children are able to live in health. Not just our children, but our children's children's children, as I said before. I think it's important to use this agency while remembering the history of this land to know what's possible for the future. Beyond development, beyond the cash, beyond even our jobs often, I think it's powerful to remember what's possible and what we can do together and what we have done together before, because we're humans. I think that if this tree gets damaged and dies, the sap of that tree will be on all of our hands, and it will not wash off. Because the children who have played on this tree during that 150 years, which I can assure you has happened a number of times, our future children will not be able to play on those branches anymore, but they'll have to deal with washing that sap off of our hands that we pass on to them, time and time and time again. In this era, we all have choices, and I think we need to start making the responsible ones. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Kim Brace and then Dave. David, maybe son? And I'm not sure if anybody's a son. I've seen some people go back to the same sheet. Okay. Yeah, you might. Is Kim Brace? No? Dave, David, and I may be mispronouncing this, D-A-V-I-D, and then it's S-E-R, S-E-N? Is there anybody else signed up on a sheet that wants to testify? Hi, wow. It's nice that we have commonality on something today. All right, there's none. Okay. All right. Let me make a couple really brief comments. What I'd like from both the applicant as well as staff is certainly comments with respect to 2 weeks adequate time for staff review of the submission today by the applicant. Okay, same list, good, okay. So I'd like timing issues. Secondly, as there was a request that there be a sort of a interim, there's a open record period and there's a kind of a comment period about what's come in during the open record period. I'd like response from both the applicant and staff on whether or not they have any objections to that. More importantly, is the applicant, is whether or not they have any problems. This is more for staff and the technical folks, but I read this statute, RS 197.763, specifically saying that I need to give 7 days for evidence and 7 days for rebuttal. I will tell you that's not what most hearings officers do in practice. Most hearings officers in practice give a period of time for open record, then a response time to react to that first week or two, whatever it happens to be, and then a final rebuttal for the applicant. I'm open to that. I'm always concerned about the time frame on the 120-day clock. So with that in mind, staff, any final comments?
I would say that we're not running up against any timeline issues. Okay. If we were to extend the time period, it'd be appreciated if we can get an extension, and I brought a form here today if the applicant chose to do that. I would just also appreciate probably more than the minimum for staff to be able to respond to new evidence.
Okay. Anything else you want to respond to as far as testimony or comment?
Not at this time.
All right, this would be time for staff's, for applicant's representative. And just as a note, apparently there's some wrappings for the large displays or something out in the lobby. Make sure whoever brought that stuff takes that stuff. It's really, we don't want to be responsible for having to take care of that. And then I will talk about the timing as soon as applicant's testimony rebuttal is completed. Go ahead, sir.
So this is Peter Fry. I just want to be clear, despite everybody's points of view and their credibility as far as their upbringing and their ancestry and all that. We do want to protect the tree. We're not here to take the tree down. We see the tree as a valuable part of this project as well as a valuable part of Portland. One of the reasons for our new plan was to incorporate the tree to be actually owned by three owners instead of one owner and then someone owning branches. And it's our opinion that three owners technically will protect the tree better than one owner, because three owners, two of the three, will always police the third. If you see, so we think that having three owners, and we also feel that's true about the environmental track. As far as the tree preservation, I brought our arborist back up to talk a little bit about it. The only point I wanted to make for the record, and this is 33.630, the word minimum has been used with two different meanings in testimony today. One meaning is that the zoning code has this minimum, and by definition, zoning code will always have minimums regardless of where they sit, whether it's half a foot or a third of a foot or 1.5 foot, inevitably there has to be a minimum. And that's developed through a legislative process. That's not to say that that is the minimum protection required, because that would not be the outcome of a process in Portland to only have the minimum protection required, which is a second meaning that's been used for the word minimum. And I just want to be clear in the record that the word minimum addresses a zoning code requirement that there be a minimum, not that that is a minimum protection. Is that clear? The other thing I thought interestingly was that it's a shallow rooted tree, which I know because I actually grew up with oak trees, and I'm pretty familiar with them personally. But the roots of the edge are not replaced, which I found interesting, as far as that seems inconsistent with one saying the life of the tree is at the edge, but the other testimony saying it's not. And that the tree is a stabilizing, because in my experience, evergreen trees that have deeper roots, and I grow trees on my property, so I'm not an expert, but I have literally 1,000 trees of all kinds. So I'd like to, that being said, I'd like the arborist to make a few points about the testimony, please.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay. So I wanted
last name again.
Last name is Prager, again, P-R-A-G-E-R. I wanted to talk a little bit about the relevant code standards as well as what is adequate protection for this specific tree. So the relevant code standard for the prescriptive path for tree protection is in section 1160.030.61 of the Portland Code. This code section considers the root zone of this tree to be a 54-foot radius around the tree. And it allows encroachments into this root zone as close as 27 feet to the tree, and impacts within that root zone of 25%. So I like to think of it as essentially 25% or a quarter of that root zone pie can be impacted by right, according to the prescriptive path. So this is the consensus standard that the City of Portland has determined is adequate for tree protection, and it's solidly supported by scientific research. When the city developed the standard, they did not just pick a standard out of the air, but based it on a plethora of research that's out there on what is needed for tree protection in the Portland region. So I'm an expert on the rooting systems of urban trees. I've published research as part of my master's degree in the flagship, or on the rooting system of trees in the flagship scientific journal, Arboriculture and Urban Forestry. In reviewing the scientific literature, the published research indicates that between 33 and up to 50% of a tree's root zone may be impacted, with minimal effects on a tree's health. The standard of our firm is to limit impacts to 25% of the root zone, assuming a root system area of 1 foot per inch of DBH, and that's to factor in a margin of safety, so we're not pushing the limits. We've applied this standard to thousands of projects in the Portland region, and we've had successful extensive success throughout our firm's history. So I consulted on this tree specifically with my colleague, Terry Flanagan. He is the president of the firm. He was also the past president of the International Society of Arboriculture. That's the body that certifies arborists throughout the world. He agreed that our proposed protection zone is more than adequate. So there is by no means consensus that the 1.5 feet per inch of DBH is necessary to protect this tree. Again, the City of Portland's own Urban Forestry Department, who has regulatory authority over trees and development situations and heritage trees, has agreed that the proposed protection zone radius of 54 feet is adequate to protect this tree. So as the arborist pointed out in his testimony, there is no consensus research on what is adequate protection for Oregon white oaks. So we must use our professional judgment when we prescribe a protection zone. Again, based on our firm's thousands of development projects in the Portland region, we believe that the proposed protection zone is adequate based on the good health and specific characteristics of this tree. And there's no disputing that the proposal meets the city's standards.
Peter Fry again. The other issue raised was 33.632 landslide. And I wanted to point out that Portland does have quite a lot of landslides that are not due to earthquakes. It's because of the shallow soil that's resting over the dirty basalt that we have, because we have a volcanic construction in geology is based on basalt, not sedimentary or other types of, which were, is where you normally find like faults. The point is that Mr. Paulus tried to explain what the staff was saying, and I'll try and be more clear. It's that we cannot analyze without specific development proposals. So what's happened now is the staff, Portland staff, and we have said that this lot configuration will allow buildings to be built in the fact of the landslide hazard area. The question of how these buildings will be built, whether they'll have pilings, what kind of basements, if not, all the foundations, all that technical stuff is developed through the building permit process, and the Portland staff has clearly said in their memo to you that the earthquake issues will be vetted entirely in the building permit process when they're looking at a specific proposal of a structure. I just want to be clear on that. That I think it's very clear, actually, what the city said. Lastly, I think what we would like, and this is obviously just our preference, not necessarily what would happen, is 2 weeks for city and everyone, 1 week for the neighborhood to respond and the neighbors to respond to what everybody said the first week. And then we as applicant would like one more week as our right to the burden of proof and our right to response. That would be our preference. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, sir.
I apologize. I wasn't, I hadn't concluded my points
yet
on that. Just had a few more to make. Okay. So my colleagues and I, when looking at this tree, we specifically discussed applying tree protection standards from other states such as California. And we disagree with that approach since all things being equal, the trees in our region are much more resilient to impacts from development due to we have a much higher rainfall amount than in California and our temperatures are much more moderate. So the root systems of trees in our region are more resilient when compared to California. And again, I have to point out as you mentioned in your opening remarks, that the relevant approval criteria, which we've met, are in the Portland code and not in the codes of other cities in other places such as California. And then finally, I wanted to point out that the 54-foot radius of tree protection is not the minimum standard. So 1160.030 allows encroachment by right of up to 25% of that root zone, and encroachments as close as 27 feet to the trunk of the tree. So the code allows additional encroachment beyond the 25% and 27 feet if approved by an arborist. So again, we're not proposing to meet the minimum protection for this tree. We're proposing 0% root zone impacts as defined by the city standards, and this is well beyond the minimum.
Okay, thank you.
I just need Mr. Fry to stay up. I need Mr. Williams to respond. Mr. Williams, you indicated that you wanted more than a week. Or what? Where? If we take Mr. Fry's proposal of 2 weeks, 1 week, 1 week, did you want more than that? Do you want that tweaked in any way? Before you answer that, for everyone, let me explain what Mr. Fry in my language said, all right? This may be what he intended, but it's what I understood. The record would be kept open for 2 weeks for anyone, not just the neighborhood, not anyone who wishes to submit testimony, whether they're here, not here, have testified, not testified, anyone, and I mean that word literally, okay? Anyone would have a right to submit into the record within a two-week period anything that they want, hopefully relevant to the case and the approval, all right? So anyone on the first 2 weeks, all right? The second week would be anyone could respond, but it's response and there could be nothing new. And this is really where the system gets difficult, all right, interpretive-wise. Because I would have to, in that 1 week period of response, make sure that nothing new is added. You're simply saying, Mr. Fry was absolutely wrong, or Mr. Prager was wrong, or Mr. Paulus was wrong, or Mr. Reynolds was wrong, or somebody was wrong, or Mr. Williams was wrong. You can say they're wrong because, but the because is already in the record. Okay? It's already there. So, first 2 weeks, anybody says anything. Second, or the second period, which is a week long, would be response by anyone. Third week, only the applicant gets to respond with their final argument, and that includes no new evidence whatsoever. And I just sent out today a Deschutes County decision where a good portion of the decision related to what was new evidence and what was not new evidence. And so trust me, I am sharp on what new evidence and not new evidence is. And you put something in there that I know isn't right, I will throw it out, okay? I won't consider it. Back to school analogy, into the brown envelope, doesn't get graded, okay? So that's my understanding of the process. Now, Mr. Williams, with that in mind, is there something you want tweaked with the process? And I'm glad to consider more time or less time, whatever you want, but I just wanted everyone to understand what those time periods meant.
It would be nice to have one more a week for response.
Mr. Fry, do you have any objections on a two-week response period?
He's asking for 3 weeks, I believe.
Well, it's 2 weeks open record, 2 weeks response, 1 week.
Got it. Okay, that'd be fine.
All right. And I'm going to give you some dates, specific dates and times. All this seems like, wow, why don't you just give me a date and time? And I'm going to do that in just a sec, but I have to figure it out. All right, here we go. And for those who didn't show up and are just listening to it on the open record, we're now going to talk about what I said I didn't talk about before. I told you how to get information, the three ways. Now I'm going to tell you when it happens and the time frame, really serious, okay? I have no sense of humor with respect to late homework, all right? So On August 6th, 2018 at 4 p.m., bewitching hour. So 4 o'clock and after, 4 o'clock and after is late. 3:59 and earlier till the day is good, all right? So open record period for anyone, August 6th, 4 p.m. Yes, Mr. Pauls?
So if the friends were going to reply to this new plan, now would be the time to do it.
If you have new evidence.
If we have new evidence.
Yes. You can, okay.
That's, I need clarification on what the response is.
Response is simply, they put in their plan today, you could respond to that. If they, actually, if they put it in up until August 6th, another new plan, you can respond. And I'll talk about that. As an attorney, there's a tweak there that attorneys can play with, but I will explain it. So until August 20th at 4 p.m., you can submit, that person didn't know what they were talking about, but you can't include anything new. So from the 23rd, or so the 6th of August to the 20th of August, new stuff, no. Argument, yes. All right, and finally, Mr. Fry, you have until 4 o'clock on the 27th for final argument. All right, my decision is due within 17 days of the closing of the record, so the record will close on the 27th of August. Mr. Fry, if after the 20th, at 4 p.m., you want the record to close early, you may make a request, and I mean the word request. It's not just because you say it doesn't mean it's true. But if you wish the record to close early, say, hi, we've got no final argument, or submit it on the next day, the 21st, and you say, we're done. I will consider closing it, but it depends on my workload, and that's your right. Secondly, and Mr. Paulus, you raised an interesting point under Oregon law, and that is that Oregon law requires after the first open record period, if something really, really, really dramatic comes in, you may submit to me a letter, and this isn't just for Mr. Paulus, this is for anyone, but you can submit to me a letter saying, wow, this is a shock, we need to be able to respond in kind with evidence to that. I would put on Mr. Fry, if he submitted a brand new, substantially different plan by 4 o'clock on the 6th, you could simply write me a letter and say, that is not fair. And that's discretionary on my part, well, kind of discretionary on my part. I think the law is pretty firm that I've got to reopen. And then I would reopen the record. I'd issue an order saying, here's the new time frame. Trust me, I hate doing that. So I don't like it when people submit really radically different things, especially from the applicant side, because theoretically the plan should have been the plan when we came here today. I understand you had a reasonable rationale and excuse, but I don't like new stuff at the hearing, and I really don't like it later. Okay, that doesn't mean you can't have a revelation, say, oh my God, here is a study about trees or landslides that none of us knew about. That would be new, but that's good stuff. Okay? So, this is the only time I ask for a response from the audience. Does everybody understand the time frame? Is there anybody in here who does not understand the time frame? Because I'm telling you, I won't be very humorous when you say, well, I didn't understand the time frame, if you say it later. Does everybody understand how the three methods work to get information into the file? In person, fax, mail. If you're going to mail it at least 3 or 4 days in advance of any deadline. At least 3 or 4 days in advance of any deadline. If you're going to fax it at least a couple hours before the deadline. If you're going to be here, be at least 5-10 minutes before the deadline. Okay? Yes, Mr. Pauls?
What's the best way to get the documents that were submitted today that are new? How do we get that from the state?
The file will be organized within the next couple hours.
Okay.
If you go outside, go to the window and say, I'd like to review the file. And everything that's been put into the file. Since we have an extended time period, I probably won't make my copies of what comes into the file, probably for another 2 weeks. And then I will come back down here, and I will actually get my copies. Because honestly, what you submitted, I haven't seen, but I made a promise, and I will look at it. Okay? Any other questions? Because this is really important. The logistics part is important.
So it's
yes, sir, way in the back. Chairman of the association.
Chairman of the association, yes.
Yeah.
Will there be a notice from the city when their response to the new updates?
No, it's going to be your responsibility.
So, okay.
You can talk to after the hearing, talk to Mr. Williams. He'll give you a phone number, and you can call him and say, have you done it? If you can get him to commit to call you, but that's not up to me. When I told you I was independent of these folks, I truly don't make friends in this building. I avoid people like the plague in this building simply because I don't want to know them well enough to make commitments on their part. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? All right, yes, Mr. Fry.
The applicant simply wants to say we agree and understand what you said.
All right, thank you. I can't remember for quite a long time now when I've had as organized and professional of approach to both sides of a case. It seems to me that the issues actually are pretty simple in this case if you were to ask me today. But I'm going to tell you that I'm going to make my decision based on the code, right? And if you want to persuade me, and it wasn't that I was trying to be disrespectful of the great stories that we had about the formation of FOOP, but we've got to be stuck with code, and you got to tell me how that works. There's a really good point from a legal perspective about what does minimum mean, what doesn't it mean, how do we apply it, those kind of things. This is a very interesting case for the gentleman, Mr. Alexander, I think it was. He's still here? But anyway, his testimony, while being a bit surreal, had a real importance to it. And we all ought to keep in mind is that humanity and caring and common sense and reasonableness is important. But when you look at this particular process, I look at the code in effect at the time the application was filed. I apply that code. As passionate as this neighborhood group is, you're missing your calling. Because city council and in the legislative process is where these kind of things, the Mr. Alexander empathy kind of things, the caring about the tree, the caring about what studies ought to be considered in the landscape, that's where these things can be fleshed out. What you really want to do in these cases from a neighborhood perspective and an applicant's perspective is take away any discretion that a hearings office or the city council has in these decisions. And that happens at the legislative process and not here. When you let a hearings officer, an unelected person, make a decision when there's a wide area of discretion, you have not done your job at the legislative process. All right? That's my lecture of the day. We will see whatever you have to submit. I appreciate your caring and considerate approach to this hearing. I wish you all well. Thank you. We'll close the hearing.
Thank you.